It's 8:17 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. The roadmap for the future of arts and culture in Summit County is built, but where does it go? In the studio to tell us about the plan and the launch of it is the director of the Park City Summit County Arts Council, Hadley Dynack. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So based on more than 900 survey responses, 17 outreach events, 31 stakeholder interviews, you have drafted a 30-plus page plan report. So what does that do?
Well, as you recall, we've been here many times over the last year. It was a year-long planning process that really arose long before that out of the advocacy of local arts and culture leaders to say we have incredible arts and culture in our community, but it's really time to invest more time, more energy, more resources in understanding what the future looks like and how we're going to resource that.
So in the introduction, it says that the plan provides direction for future investment in arts and culture. You note that over the last 20 years, government and nonprofit organizations and individuals have made significant investments in recreation and open space, but similar investments haven't been made in arts and culture. So is it because people prefer open space and recreational amenities?
Well, I think that's a good point. I think a lot of people do come here because of their love of the mountains and outdoor space, and we want to preserve and protect those assets in our community without a doubt. This is not really about saying we don't want to support open space and recreation, but rather we want to invest additional resources in our community as we grow to make sure that we have a sustainable and vital arts and culture future. It's a significant part of the quality of life for residents that live here. It's an incredible draw for our destination tourists when they're looking around at where they want to come for their trip with their family. Having, a very robust set of activities that include a significant arts and culture infrastructure is a real asset across the board for locals and visitors.
When we look at some of the larger cultural organizations, of course, we've got the Kimball Arts Center and Sundance, both building big new headquarters, the Egyptian Theater with its historic theater programming some four nights a week. Park City Institute has the Eccles Center. What cultural opportunities are we missing here?
So this roadmap, this cultural plan, first of all, is a countywide plan. So it's looking at what the future holds both in Park City proper as well as in the Basin and North and South Summit. So the examples that you just listed are primarily in historic downtown Main Street, incredible assets and amenities for our community. But I think it's important to think outside historic Main Street. Another part of this is that we used a really broad definition of what arts and culture is. So we talked about the programming, the events, the activities by our main kind of hub cultural organizations. But we're also talking about public art. We're talking about art education. We're talking about supporting the artists, the makers, the creative entrepreneurs who are taking a vision and making it reality in our community. We're talking about connecting the various hubs where arts and culture happens so that people can understand where they exist and how to access them. We're talking about using data so we can really understand growth over time and the impact of that growth. We're talking about, supporting people and creating programs to become an exporter of talent as opposed to just an importer of programming and talent. So it's really a very broad plan. The other piece of it is, as we're developing as a community, we continuously talk about new developments that are happening across the county. How can we use arts and culture as a tool to create mindful communities in those new developments so that they're not just houses or commercial spaces, but they're really connecting people together through planned design that creates an opportunity for arts and culture to come and play a part of that?
So you use the word support several times. Is that financial support? What other kind of support what would they need?
Sure. I think the plan, so first of all, there are seven priorities that emerged out of all of the data collection that you just reviewed. And those are kind of big buckets of need, if you will, or ways to organize information. And within each of those priorities are a set of recommendations. And you'll see, and hopefully the community will go to projectabcsc.com, which is the website where the plan lives, and the entire website's been revamped to reflect the findings of the research phase, that there are a number of different recommendations that are beyond what we might say support equals funding. Funding is an important part of this, without a doubt. But we're talking about professional development. We're talking about how can we create spaces for people to come together and learn from each other? How can we incorporate arts education in a deeper way and integrate it into our schools and in our extracurricular activities, especially in places maybe where they're not quite as robust as others? So I think it stretches far beyond support equals funding, although that is, like I said, a major part of it.
Well, as you mentioned, there are seven collective priorities that have been outlined in the plan, and maybe I'll just run through them. Spaces, data, places, funding, government and policy, faces, and programming. So let's start with spaces. You talk about developing, supporting, and protecting high-quality facilities for the creation, cultivation, exhibition of arts and culture countywide. So give me an example here. I mean, you're looking for space for artists, local artists to perform, to sell their goods, to be able to create their art?
Yeah, I think spaces are really about venues and facilities. And what we heard over and over again from the data is that the community really wants spaces for locally focused events and activities. So if you think about the Kimball Arts Center's arts education programming, I think it's a perfect example. But right now it happens primarily in one place. And the place is the geography where it exists. So how can we think about, you know, using other spaces to bring arts education forward, as an example? How can we not only create spaces for arts education, but how can we create spaces for local artists who have work that they want to share with the community? Right now, it's very difficult for a local artist to exhibit and sell their work. Most of the galleries have local representation of a few artists, but there are no locally owned artist co-op spaces. There's no place for artists to go together and work outside of, you know, some private facilities that are out near the junction that are in transition right now. So I think there's a lot of potential here to create spaces, which again are venues and facilities that will meet local needs. At the same time, we heard that it's not just about locals, it's about creating kind of world-class destination spaces for our visitors. And, you know, we don't need probably multiple large format venues and outdoor amphitheaters, but right now we have one, and it's Deer Valley, and there's some changes that have been happening there. So is there a need for something else? And as some of these other developments are happening around the community, where should those go, and who should fund them, and how should they be programmed?
Yeah, so a couple things came to mind listening to you. I mean, one, we've got a $20 million piece of property that we're building an arts and culture district. Mm-hmm. Again, that's within Park City Municipal.
Yep.
So that's something you want to see go elsewhere, I mean, countywide. But we also used to have an artist co-op right on Main Street. And maybe that was before it became too expensive to, you know, rent a business on Main Street. But certainly in some of these other smaller areas, I mean, we've got Artique and Camus. I mean, it seems to me there's probably some place in Colville, too, so that are reasonable. So, I mean, what is it that you want us to do? I guess isn't this an artist, a collective artist's challenge to them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the way that we've always thought about this planning process is a coalition model. So we brought together all different kinds of stakeholders from a variety of different sectors or groups, right? We brought together the business community, the artist community, the nonprofit community. The government sector came and participated, and some individual philanthropists and funders. And it's like, what are the collective kind of needs, wants, and dreams of the community, and how can this plan serve as a roadmap or as a document to help drive those forward? So it's not about creating a to-do list for any one organization in the community. There's nobody that necessarily, quote-unquote, owns this document and is responsible for seeing its accomplishments executed. What it is it's a document that every single stakeholder that's interested in arts and culture can use to validate their decisions, to inform their decisions, and then to figure out ways that they can partner with others who maybe have the same ideas and visions moving forward. I do think that, you know, you mentioned Bonanza Park, and while a number of the priorities are discrete in and of themselves, others are going to have far far-reaching impacts. So Bonanza Park's success hinges upon the fact that it's got multiple things going to be happening there, right? It's not just one organization. It's multiple organizations partnering together to create a space for arts and culture, to create a place that doesn't exist right now in that, to program it, and then to use resources to help the people that are going to live there. There's going to be housing. There's going to be transit. There's going to be potentially maker space. There'll be programming. So it really cuts across a number of the seven priorities and is a perfect example, I think, of one of the stakeholders, in this case the city, saying we're doubling down and investing in arts and culture in a significant and new way, and look at how it overlaps and meets a number of these goals.
So it sounds like this is a kind of call out to Summit County, the basin, and some of the outlying communities. I mean, it's, you know, when we look at the arts and culture within Park City Municipal, it's full. We've got lots.
We have lots of events and activities. I think if you talk to the creatives, they might feel like they could use more support. They could use more places to exhibit their work, more opportunities to learn from each other or to develop their businesses. If you talk to young people, they may say they don't feel like they have enough places to go to learn, I don't know, music education, or to play a gig in a space that would be an all ages listening room type venue. There aren't those kinds of amenities in our community right now.
Some of the other, you mentioned places, and you kind of referred to that, the significant investment Deer Valley is going to be putting into its amphitheater. But really, we're looking for one for nonprofit use as opposed, well, I mean, I guess they allow the symphony there. So I guess, I mean, what else in terms of places and just these other areas? And you think about it, Deer Valley, private business, private property, it's expanding its culture there. I guess I don't get why, what you're asking for then. I mean, and what you wanted to do. It sounds like you've got to get to the people who want this and develop the resources from within them as opposed to the rest of us.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. I don't think that there's necessarily a call to action to the general public as a here's something that you should do right now, other than you could go and if you believe in this idea of greater arts and culture investment in our community, you could go to the website and take the Project ABC pledge, which is a digital high five saying, I think that this is important and I think our community needs to double down here. I think over 1,100 people in our community already have done that. But again, like, we are seeing this document and this process as a way that Deer Valley, for example, can think about the work that they're doing in their amphitheater and can reference this document and can say, you know, if we're going to develop this amphitheater, let's think about all of the different things that the community has asked for as part of that plan and how can we incorporate elements of that in it. And Bob Wheaton and Carrie Westberg have been part of this project and I think have indicated that they are interested in using some of the core ideas of this plan for their work. The Canyons development is another one. You know, there's tons of development going to be happening there. So how can the entities out there think about these various priorities and recommendations and use them as they're making decisions about their work there?
So data is another collective priority. What is it that you want to do there?
You know, I think it's really important if you don't have good data, it's really hard to document where you are and where you've gone and what the value is. And we don't have good data on arts and culture right now. We can pull a little bit of information out of some of the county granting documents, but right now there's no kind of accessible public granting portal, for example, where you can pull out reports on what the nonprofit attendance are across events. Different organizations collect all that, but there's no central way to do it. We're not looking at economic development and the impact of arts and culture on our economy in a systematic way. We started that with this plan and did a pretty thorough initial state-of-the-arts assessment looking at jobs and audience spending and funding, but there's far more that we can do to really look at progress over time. And in communities that really have that data, you know, you can not only see change over time in your place, but you can ideally compare it to other places to see how you're stacking up in similar communities or communities that you aspire to be.
Funding, of course, another collective priority. The biggest issues are finding new funding mechanisms. So what do those look like? And
Yeah, there's not a lot of funding right now for arts and culture outside of the county grants, which are the wrap and the restaurant tax grants that are fairly restrictive in what the funds can be used for. The city, of course, offers special service agreements to a number of arts and culture organizations, which is incredibly valuable, as well as fee waivers for a number of events. So don't mistake me to say that there's not investment, but they're very kind of specific buckets of investment that aren't necessarily going to evolve to meet some greater needs. So what I think this plan is, or what I know this plan is calling for, you know, is really looking creatively at additional public and private sources for funding. We can look at additional public sources at the local, state, and federal level. So there's a variety of different options there. And the plan also calls for looking for some additional private investments. And there's some creative models and strategies we can use from some of our benchmark communities. We looked at 8 other communities and how they fund arts and culture, as well as some of the things that specifically have been outlined in this proposal, whether it's, you know, getting developers to do a private percent, to consider a private percent for art programs similar to our public percent for art that could fund a pool of resources that could go back into the community, you know, to looking at things like restaurant roundups and you know, a variety of other mechanisms that could create new resources.
And governance policy is another one. And what I read was that you're looking for structures, systems, and policies to support the sustained vitality of arts and culture. So do I hear a new arts council role? I mean, because it seems like you're that organization and you're that person, is that liaison to the counties and cities.
Yeah, and I think we're the Arts Council, you know, has grown significantly in the last couple of years and, you know, really is proud of the work we've done and the leadership that we had in moving this plan forward. And I think one of the plan's, you know, recommendations is that we need to identify, you know, kind of a backbone organization, if you will, and resource that organization so that it can really oversee the growth and sustainability of this sector in our community. Neither the city nor the county presently have dedicated arts and culture staff. And if you look at a recreation model, for example, you can see the difference where there's significant resources invested in facilities and space that are owned by public entities or special services districts that are managing the infrastructure and delivering programming. And right now in the arts and culture space, we don't have that. And I don't know exactly what the model is. I think that, you know, the Arts Council is definitely willing to step into a greater role, but it has to be done, you know, in partnership and collaboration, both with Parks City Municipal, Summit County government, as well as the East Side governments and cities.
So as I kind of started off, I mean, we've got the roadmap now for the future, but what direction are you going in? I mean, where do we go from here?
Yeah, so we have the plan, and as with all plans, there's the risk that the plan kind of sits somewhere. But I think that the idea with this from the beginning was to use a coalition model so that it really this plan and this process represents actions to be taken by multiple stakeholder groups. And when you have a lot of people that have been sitting at the table for a year plus, you know, there's ideally a lot of idea and energy to move things forward. I think that's the case in most respects with this plan. And I think continued advocacy is necessary to see action, to make sure that things are moving forward. The Arts Council, you know, is committing to overseeing and tracking implementation progress on this. Somebody kind of needs to be the quote-unquote watchdog to make sure it continues and doesn't just sit there. And I think that, like I said, we really see an opportunity to build a leadership role and take on a number of actions that are relevant to our work, whether it's building our capacity to tell stories about local arts and culture, which we do already and is a recommendation of the plan, and maybe working with, you know, others that do that type of marketing and joining efforts and resources there, to working on the data piece to document the impact overall across the county and the growth of arts and culture in our economy. And, you know, the big issue of looking at ways to explore how we can raise more money so that we can accomplish more in our community and see greater investment and return in the arts and culture space.
So are we going to see you presenting this plan then to the different communities in the county?
So all of the stakeholders have endorsed the plan. You can read the plan itself. You can download it on the website and see that. And so that includes all of the relevant people that have participated in the process so far. But yes, I think it's important that we continue to advocate for the future of arts and culture in our community. It's up to all of the stakeholders in our community at large to ensure and hold them accountable for taking on pieces of work that's relevant for them and using this document as a decision-making tool.
It's 8:37 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the local news hour on KPCW. Well, staff at the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District racked up a number of awards at the annual conference of the Water Environment Association of Utah. Also winning an award from the Utah Local Government Trust. In the studio, I have District Director Mike Lures. Good morning. Congratulations.
Oh, good morning. Thank you.
Yeah. So, I mean, seven awards, that's pretty impressive. Is this of all Utah water reclamation, or do we go a little bit further than just the state?
The first four awards were issued based on a state basis. So they issued one of these for the entire state of Utah, and then two of them were national awards. And then we received a safety award from the local government trust.
Yeah. So is this something that you go ahead and submit? I mean, you take the time to do this?
We either submit an application ourselves or someone nominates us, and then wastewater professionals made up of a number of wastewater utilities from around the state visit each site for each award, and then they do a very thorough review of what type of work you've done, and then they base the award based on their interviews and site visits.
Yeah, so why is it important, though, that you file those applications if you did?
Well, we'd like to recognize the hard work of our staff. You know, have worked very hard to maintain a healthy workplace for not only the public but our staff. And our safety record reflects that. We work very closely, say, with the fire district on confined spaces, which is a big deal to us. It's a very dangerous occupation. And then the way we maintain our system, our collection system, which is all the pipes that we have like 300 miles of pipes and 7,000 manholes. We received an award for the way we maintain that. And our supervisor that's in charge of that department also received an award. And then our chemist received the National Laboratory Excellence Award, Tiffany Adams. And then one of our other staff members, Chad Burrell, won the National Author Sidney Bedell Award, which is an award for his service as editor to the state-wide wastewater magazine.
Well, great. While you're here, get an update on the multi-million-dollar reconstruction of the Silver Creek Treatment Plant. Again, this is a multi-million, how many million-dollar project?
This is a $51 million project. We started construction a little over 2 years ago, and we have about 18 months of additional construction to complete. We're on schedule, on budget. It's all looking good. It's a very complex project because we're having to tear down the wastewater treatment plant and rebuild it at the same time, never shutting it down. It's kind of like having your house torn down and rebuild it, but never leave the home. So it's a complex, difficult job, but kudos to our staff and our contractor and our engineers, and we're on schedule.
Yeah. Could you divert it, though, to East Canyon?
No, we couldn't. No, we cannot.
So what if there was an emergency or something? What would you do?
We don't let that happen. Yeah. Well, you know, there's certain points in time when you disconnect the old pipe and you connect it to the new pipe. And we usually do that, say, 3 o'clock in the morning when flows are lower, but not completely, you know, zero. And we rehearse those activities, and we have, you're talking about, you know, measuring a piece of wood. Well, these are things that you measure a dozen times to ensure that you have everything in place, because there's absolutely no room for a mistake, because it's not like we can call people up and say, you know, don't flush. It just doesn't happen that way.
Right. So this $51 million is being paid for how?
93% of it is being paid for by new growth. And the last 7% is our current customers. And that's because we're increasing the level of treatment to advanced tertiary treatment to protect downstream reservoirs. So, the vast majority of it is new growth, which is occurring very rapidly. Matter of fact, it's happening at such a rate that we are already starting preliminary planning on the next expansion.
And that's going to be at East Canyon?
That'll be at East Canyon, yes.
Yeah. And we did see rates go up recently. Right. Will we see them go up again?
We're going to see an annual increase between 2% and 3%. Part of that is inflation. Part of it is the additional treatment requirements that we're faced at both treatment plants. Even though we have advanced treatment, some of the specific parameters that we have to test for are continuing to be we're tighter limits and harder to remove. So, 2 to 3%, but we do not anticipate any large increases.
All right, and the what you're doing? I mean, it's to advance the tertiary treatment. Right. What is that going to do?
What advanced treatment is in our case in both of our treatment facilities to remove the nutrients, phosphorus in particular. So phosphorus is responsible for such things as harmful algae blooms. You hear these toxic algae blooms, say, down at Utah Lake and Deer Creek and other places. And we want to remove our portion of the phosphorus to avoid those type of toxic situations.
Yeah. You talked about growth. I mean, what are we seeing in terms of growth? I mean, is it anything like we saw before and after the Olympics?
No, the peak growth that we saw, and this is when, like, the montage came on and massive projects like that, we were selling around 1,000 connections a year. Right now, we're about 450, but 2018 has turned out to be a pretty strong year. We may exceed that number, but I don't think we will ever reach the 1,000 mark that we saw previously.
Yeah, I mean, and we heard about all of the building going on, of course, there at the base of the canyon.
And so our staff is intimately involved in all those projects at the canyons, as well as the Silver Creek Village area. So we're very busy.
Well, and that's what I was going to say. Are you ready to take care of? I mean, we know we got 1,300 at Silver Creek. I don't even know how many at
Well, that's the reason for the expansion at Silver Creek, to handle the growth. And then as growth continues to take place, we'll have to continue to expand to meet the need.
Yeah, and then canyons would actually head out to East Canyon,
that's
right?
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah. And then with what looks like it's going to be a dry summer, how does that impact what you do? Yeah.
During these dry years where we have these low snowpacks, we anticipate the flow in East Canyon Creek getting down to very low levels. And that's a huge problem for us because at that point, the wastewater that we discharge, you might say, is the creek and has to be of such quality to support our native trout species, such as the Bonneville cutthroat trout. So when the flows get low, you know, we are it. We're responsible for keeping those fish alive, and that's the reason we have this advanced tertiary treatment. But as the amount of wastewater continues to increase, there is a problem with the low levels of pharmaceuticals that we're seeing, and we've been looking into this situation for 10 years now, and we will most likely do some additional studies this summer. We've been waiting for a dry year, so to speak. And this looks like it. So we're working with Baylor University to conduct some additional studies as to the impact of pharmaceuticals and estrogens on downstream fish populations. And we'll be looking at that in the next 60 days.
So this is a pretty small community. I mean, it's not like we've got lots of women out there. I mean, creating this issue. I mean, how do other places deal with it, or they're not?
Well, most places have dilution, quite honestly. And when we don't have a stream flow, the fish are living in 100% wastewater, even though it's highly treated. Our wastewater treatment plants were never designed to remove pharmaceuticals. So everything from estrogens to Prozac to, you know, heart medicines, we pick up all those compounds downstream. And some of these compounds will, you know, remain in a stream for 13, 14 miles all the way down to the reservoir. So they don't break down very easily. So that's a big problem. And what we want to know is how can we measure the actual impact of these compounds in such a way that we can protect the fish. And it's a tough, expensive studies to do all that.
Yeah. So when do you expect to have some results from that?
If we proceed with the study this summer, it'll be probably next year at this time, because there's a huge amount of very high-tech laboratory analysis that will take place, and that would take place, in this case, down at Baylor University. and we have a couple PhD students working on that. So we haven't started the study yet, but we're discussing it.
Yeah, so it's not just like a filter is going to work here, right? Is it going to be some kind of chemical?
Yeah, we've actually performed a number of bench scale and pilot tests, so we know how to do it. So we actually add ozone and peroxide, which is a chemical. Everybody's pretty well familiar with, say, hydrogen peroxide. And we have to break these organic molecules down to basic building blocks, such as, you know, oxygen and water, to protect the fish. And to do that costs a lot of money, Ozone and peroxide is one of the options, and that appears to be the cheapest option. We would generate ozone on site, which is just a form of oxygen, and then add hydrogen peroxide with it, and you oxidize these organic molecules down to basic building blocks.
Hmm. I mean, when I think of hydrogen peroxide, yeah, I think of that little jar for, you know, 79 yeah cents, but it's...
Well, the equipment to generate the ozone and to put high enough doses in to take these very resilient organic molecules and start breaking them down, it, you know, it's tens of millions of dollars.
It's not the chemicals, it's the equipment
to do it.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Mike?
No. Appreciate it. And again, kudos to our staff and our Board of Trustees for a job well done.
Yeah. Good job. Thank you. It's Mike Lures, Director of the Snyderville Basin Water Reclamation District. It's 8:50 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. Well, coming May 12th at both 1 and 6 o'clock, the students at the Ballet West Academy in Park City will be presenting their spring recital in the studio. With details, I have Campus Administrator Sandy Fleury. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
So two shows, as I mentioned. When and where?
At the Eccles Center, 1 p.m. and 6 p.m.
Okay. And there's a cost to it?
There is. Reserve seats are $15 and general admission is $12.
Okay. And they can do that online?
You can do that online at 22tutix.com.
Okay. And so the program is the Wonderful Wizard of Oz. How many kids do you have performing?
Well, in the show, we have about 250. We open the show with a variety show of the students that have been taking tap and jazz and hip-hop, different styles. So we have a variety show for about 45 minutes. And then after intermission, we present our original Wonderful Wizard of Oz, which is the ballet department. And this year, rather than having a classical ballet, we created similar to our Nutcracker, where we have, it's kind of a multi-genre storyline. The great thing is we took the book and created the story, and it's more contemporary. It's not a classical ballet. It's a contemporary ballet, and it's really fun. We just had the dress rehearsal at the studio on Saturday, and it is going to be darling.
Okay. Because that's what I was wondering, if it was just a ballet, but you got the other students performing as well beforehand. So.
Correct.
Yeah. Do all of the kids that participate in the programs part of something here?
They're all, everyone that takes a class at the campus here in Park City will be in this show. Not everyone will be in the Wonderful Wizard of Oz. It's the ballet department that's presenting the Wonderful Wizard of Oz. And then the first part is the contemporary and tap department. And our littles. We're putting our littles, obviously, in the beginning of the show, while they still have attention and their costumes on.
Okay, again, that's this Saturday at 1 and 6 o'clock at the Eccles Center, 22tix.com. So what are your plans for the summer? Do you guys take it off or do you continue with classes?
We're going to take a couple weeks off in June. We end with a party in the parking lot May 30th with all the students that have been taking through the school year. We take a couple weeks off in June, and then we start with a dance camp and a storybook camp for children age 3 to 18. The dance camp is for older and obviously storybook for younger. And then we're going to follow, after the 4th of July, we'll have 3 weeks of a ballet workshop. And that'll be 4 hours a day of ballet with a different supplemental each day, too. They may have flamingo, they may have character, but a lot of ballet technique and point technique. That's for 3 weeks. Then we host 6 high school dance teams for dance camp. And then after that, we do another storybook dance camp, and then we have our performance team camp, and then school starts and we start again. It goes really fast.
Yeah. And I also noticed on the calendar, August 25th, auditions for Nutcracker. So is this anybody that...
Okay, so those auditions are for the Downtown Nutcracker. We hold our auditions after we've started, and we do that in September, and we start the our rehearsals in October. So the Downtown Nutcracker are having, August 25th, are having their auditions. We are again presenting the Nutcracker here in Park City. It's just so popular that, we're having a hard time replacing it with a different story at this point. And that's mostly our students from our studio, where the one downtown you can be from any studio and audition for.
Yeah. Do you have some of your students, though?
That go downtown? Definitely.
That make it, huh?
Yeah, yeah.
And perform.
They go down. And they have four casts of children down in the downtown. So you have to have pretty strong ballet technique, but it's not so limited that you worry about making it.
Yeah. And then just the merger that happened, a couple of years ago now, has it been good? I mean, what are some of the benefits that you've seen as a result of it?
Some of the benefits for me personally, because I was involved with the studio before it was purchased by Ballet West, is the outreach ability. By it being a not-for-profit, I've seen our ability to reach out more to the Latinos. We have a great program where we're including Latinos into our programs. It's not a specific Latino class. They're just integrated into our classes. But we can do more fundraising. We can have scholarships. And bigger organization has more... they have a marketing department. They have these different departments that we didn't have.
Yeah. And I think that the inclusion of the Latino community, that's part of that whole Solomon Fund program.
Yes, Vino Solomons through the Park City Community Foundation. And we're collaborating really well with them. And I am really enjoying that.
Great. All right, anything else you want to mention?
Nope, just come see the world premiere I saw of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz.
Okay, that's 22tix.com. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Leslie.